This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Right now, across the country, petitions in all 50 states are calling for secession from the U.S. After the re-election of President Barack Obama, these citizens are so convinced the country's on the wrong track, they want to leave and start their own nations. Talk of secession is at once a little shocking and a little ridiculous. Keep in mind that only a small number of Americans are actually calling for separation. For example, in North Carolina, a state with more than 9.6 million people, about 30,000 people have signed the petition. And, of course, secession is illegal. Still, the petitions raise interesting questions about democracy and what it takes to keep a country together. So this hour, we're going to talk about secession and revolution. What are they? How are they different? And what leads people to decide they've had enough of their nation? Joining us now to talk about this is James Zink. He is an assistant professor of political science at North Carolina State University. James, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also joining us by phone, Don Doyle, professor of history at the University of South Carolina and editor of the book Secession as an International Phenomenon, From America's Civil War to Contemporary Separatist Movements. Welcome, Don.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here, too.
Well, James, let me start with you. The current secession movement, is something, do we take it seriously?
Well, my inclination right now is to not take it too seriously. It's sort of reminiscent of liberals responding to George W. Bush's election with threats to move to Canada. And I think, you know, one of the guests that you'll have on in a bit, Brandon, has done some work mapping out on a county-by-county basis where the signers of these petitions come from. And it, if you compare that map with an electoral map, a county-by-county breakdown of the 2012 presidential election, what you see is there's a considerable correlation between mm-hmm. where these mm-hmm. signers are coming from and counties that went for Romney. So right now, it's tempting to chalk it up to a little bit of venting on electoral outcome that people were unsatisfied with.
Obviously, venting, sour grapes, all of that is true. And yes, liberals claiming they have to go to Canada. They cannot bear another Bush administration. But it's one thing to leave. And this is secession, Don. And it's kind of interesting that this is the way the venting has occurred. What do you make of that, that this is the way the sour grapes are expressed?
Well, I think that that Jim is right that there's a lot of post-election angst and people thinking that so much was at stake at this election that if their candidate didn't win, that things will go to hell and that they've got to leave. Of course, the original meaning of secession, it goes back to ancient Rome, actually does mean the withdrawal of people from the city. The plebes of Rome used to withdraw in an act of secessio as a protest, to try to protest the government. That's a different meaning from the territorial division of a nation, but it is, by this older meaning, one solution that if people don't like a country or don't like a government, they do have the option of leaving. Now, secession, you're right, was at least determined by the verdict of the battlefield in the U.S. to be illegal or unacceptable. But so far as I know, there's never been any law in the United States preventing from people leaving and self-reporting.
Right. And I should say that the North Carolina Constitution does specifically prohibit secession. So I don't know about other constitutions. But, James, we do think about secession in the U.S. in terms of the Civil War. Any relationship between this movement and what we saw in the American Civil War?
Well, I think, you know, there are a variety of petitions, and I think at least some of these petitions – implicitly make a kind of argument. I mean, they aren't legal documents, so they aren't real coherent in sort of the basis of their claims. But some of them seem to implicitly make an argument that's similar to the kind of argument you saw from Calhoun and his allies. And that argument's basically the Constitution is an agreement among equal, independent, sovereign states. Through that agreement, the states have sort of delegated certain powers to federal government, but those powers are limited. Right, the 10th Amendment makes clear the federal government only has those powers that are enumerated in the Constitution, and all other powers are reserved to the states. So whenever the federal government does something that doesn't fall under one of those powers specified in the Constitution, it's treading on the states. It's usurping state authority. And now the key, I think, that Calhoun seizes on is that there's implicit in the Constitution, in the very nature of the constitutional agreement, a legal right or remedy whenever the federal government oversteps its constitutional boundaries, and that is secession. So he portrays it as a legal right that's implicit in the Constitution and the nature of American Union. There's a right whenever there's any sort of breach of those enumerated powers, there's a right of a state or states to unilaterally secede from the Union. Lincoln disagrees with that.
Lincoln disagrees, and of course, so what he says is you're in rebellion and this is treason.
That's right. And so the distinction that Lincoln seizes on, I mean, he's got a different interpretation of the Constitution, a different understanding of American Union, and his understanding of the relationship between the state and federal governments is such that there's no – it doesn't countenance any notion of a legal right to secede. So what does he think they're doing? He thinks they're engaged in revolution. And the key distinction here is that if Calhoun's right and that there's a legal right implicit in the Constitution, then there's a corresponding legal obligation on the part of the federal government to allow the state to secede peaceably. If Lincoln's right and what they're engaged in is revolution, that's an exercise of an extra legal right. And there is no corresponding obligation on the part of the federal government to go along with it. And Lincoln's pretty clear he's going to fight tooth and nail, right? And Lincoln's a good student of the Declaration of Independence. So you played the Ron Paul clip at the opening, right? He understands that there is this natural right to revolution that's an important and he cherishes it as an important cornerstone of Americans' understanding of political legitimacy. So he doesn't deny that states have the this right. He's just saying that there, as an extra legal right, there's no obligation for him to go along with it. And in fact, since he doesn't think they have a just cause to do it, he's prepared to fight too.
And he does, and he goes to war. So, Don, let's make the distinction here and now, because we're going to talk about both secession and revolution in this program. They are two different things. The Declaration of Independence, not a founding legal document, but it does say that whenever any form of government is destructive of those rights we just enumerated, the people have the right to alter or abolish their government. That's revolution. So make the distinction for us, Don, between secession and revolution.
Well, the Confederates used that term secession very deliberately to imply peaceful withdrawal and not a revolutionary action that was based in a violent overthrow of an existing government. They took care, at least in many of the states, to have plebiscites and to set up a government and to make it clear that this was a peaceful transition from, as Jim said, a compact, a voluntary compact in the United States of America, and now to independence as states. And then a third step was to form a new nation or a new federal government, the Confederate States of America. Now, the right to revolution is based, and in Lincoln's mind and in the Declaration of Independence, on past abuses, on suffering, tyranny, injustice, the deprivation of natural rights. One of the logical problems that the Confederacy had at that time was that they were anticipating problems that would come with the election of Abraham Lincoln. So it was a preemptive withdrawal, and most of the complaints are set in future tense rather than what Jefferson called the long train of abuses.
So this might upset their legal argument, but it does raise these larger questions about what is secession, what is revolution. We call it the American Revolution, and of course the Declaration of Independence is justification for that. Is it a revolution or is it a secession? Is it a part of a British empire that breaks away from the mother country, Don?
The American Revolution, I think, is really the kind of the gold standard for a separatist, secessionist movement. Now, one of the things that characterized that, and the Declaration of Independence would become literally a model that people would kind of download and fill in the blanks, and you see David Armitage describe some 400 different declarations of independence that had been modeled after the 1776 model. But usually it is just that, a declaration of sovereignty rather than a petition. They were not asking Britain if they could secede, or even announcing that they were going to. They simply announced that we have had enough. Here are the reasons why. I think they listed over two dozen of them and left many more on the cutting room floor, and then said, now we are the United States of America, and we will meet our former rulers and friends in peace and enemies in war. And then, of course, part of the business of withdrawing is that most nations and empires do not readily give up resources, territory, and people without a fight. And so then came the other phase of this, and that was defending the claim to independence with blood.
And interestingly enough, it's at once, as you say, a secessionist movement. But you talked about the Confederate states trying to get consensus within the state for these for this separation. And yet we know famously the American Revolution was not supported by two-thirds of the population. A third actively resisted and one-third was indifferent. So you have essentially a secessionist movement run by about a third of the population of the colonies.
That's right. And, of course, many of those who called themselves loyalists, that is, loyal to Britain, they seceded in effect by going to Canada, many of them, during and after the Revolution. Yes, it's always contested, and often declarations that are made in the name of the people are very often the more radical fringes of the people expressing grievances that other people might share but are not willing to shed blood for.
So you see, sometimes these small minorities do get their way. On the State of Things today, talking with James Zink, Assistant Professor of Political Science at North Carolina State, and Don Doyle, Professor of History at the University of South Carolina, author of Secession as an International Phenomenon from America's Civil War to Contemporary Separatist Movements. We'll talk more about this just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about revolution and secession. What distinguishes the two? What leads part of a country to want to break away from the entire state? With us, James Zink. He is Assistant Professor of Political Science at North Carolina State. Don Doyle's with us, a professor of history at the University of South Carolina. He's editor of the book Secession as an International Phenomenon. And James, really quick, we want to reestablish the difference between secession and revolution.
Right. Well, within the context of that debate between, you know, the Southern secessionists and someone like Lincoln, the distinction that Lincoln really seizes on is this difference between a legal right to peaceably secede and the corresponding obligation of the federal government to allow the states to secede versus the extra legal right, the natural right to revolution, which doesn't create that that corresponding legal obligation. And so when you and this is a distinction that James Madison actually adhered to as well. Right. There are certain legal remedies in any kind of dispute between the states and the federal government. But the ultimate remedy is, as he puts it, the appeal to the heaven or the natural right to revolution.
And that can happen either by overthrowing the central government and changing things for everybody or pulling away illegally without that legal right and changing things for the people within your region.
Right, because that's a fundamental, in their view, in Madison's, I think, as well as Lincoln's, a fundamental alteration of government.
So, Don, there's another distinction we want to make, too, because you've done research into separatist movements around the world. So we think of the Basque separatists in Spain, the Quebecois in Quebec, Canada, the IRA, for instance. How does that relate to this question? Are separatist movements in other parts of the world revolutionaries? Describe some of those for us.
Well, it's a mixed history. Nations are born in violence and of course, those that win and establish independence will write their own histories and talk about how they were destined to become an independent nation, and that it was distinctions of language and culture and history and shared memories and so on that, and of course, shared oppression against the former rulers. And so there's, I think it's estimated that of today's almost 200 nation states in the United Nations, almost half of them have their origin as breakaway states. And again, the United States is kind of the gold standard for the historic process in the modern world of nations breaking away. It's often attended by violence, but not always. And you know, one of the after the American Civil War, I think that a lot of dissident minorities within empires and nations thought long and hard before engaging in a huge war for separation. The discontent was still there, but you don't see a real flurry of secessionist movements until later, after World War I, and then, of course, after World War II, and then after the Cold War. So often the global history surrounding secession sees bursts of secessionist movement as empires and strong nations are broken up or weakened in some way.
I was going to ask you right here, though, that in some cases we have people, separatist movements, revolutionary movements, where people have a cultural affinity and yet political differences. I'm thinking of, in great the United Kingdom, the IRA,
yeah.
Compared to the Basques in Spain, who see themselves as culturally apart from a dominant political group.
Yes, and often the language of separatism, of nationalism, begins with this, a kind of cultural statement, we are a people, and then a political goal, we want a government of our own. And that kind of nationalism, it runs through most all nations, whether or not they broke away from another nation or empire in their birth. It's often violent. Violence isn't the same thing as revolution, but it's often a violent process. And at the same time, there are some examples of peaceful separation. One that's always cited is the separation of Norway from Sweden in 1905, and it was done by a plebiscite and decided with ink rather than blood. But these are rare, and most of these breakaway nations are born in, they have very violent births.
And it's interesting, James, if you think about, again, the United States, the American Revolution, in a way, brings into the world the nation state in a lot of ways. So these cultural ties, are they less important with the birth of the United States than they are in places like Spain and like the United Kingdom, where language and shared memory tend to be the defining, the markers?
Well, I wouldn't I wouldn't really say that. I don't think they're less important, although simple shared circumstances, I think, was, you know, really important in the American case. Just to echo something that Don said, it's sort of these movements, whether you want to call them separatist movements or revolutions in the case of America, I mean, it could qualify as both. I mean, they clearly think they're engaged in revolution, but they also, you know, it's a war for independence. But it does start with this this statement of shared principles and this idea of not necessarily nationhood but sort of unity, right? If you think of the second paragraph of the Declaration, which is the sexy one, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident. It's not an assertion that these are self-evident truths. It's truths that we hold to be self-evident. And so the basis of commonality that at least Jefferson is trying to establish among these separate colonies are these shared principles of political reasoning, these first principles of political reasoning, those natural rights principles of legitimacy. And that's the basis that America is separating on, and what he hopes is going to be the cornerstone principles for whatever form the subsequent organization of American government would take. And of course, we know in the American case, it's not too long before people start the states start going their own way, right, under the Articles of Confederation, and end up not being that workable. So you have this sort of statement of unity, this statement of commonality, If there isn't that strong cultural affinity, I think it tends to fall apart rather quickly.
Right. We are the ones who hold these truths. And
right.
So, and that's the point. And for those of you who don't, you don't have to believe it.
Right.
But if you do, you're part of the party, and welcome to the club. So, but again, if you look, Don, at places where nation states were cobbled together in the aftermath of World War I,
yeah.
Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, those two countries break apart in far different ways back to their constituent states after not very long, but it still happens violently in Yugoslavia and peacefully in Czechoslovakia.
Yes, and I think there's an idea in most nationalist ideologies that there are certain natural definitions of a people, of a nation, an idea of a common line of descent, common blood, as we say it, as well as common language, culture, and so on. Most of these are mythical concoctions. These things we call nations have been cobbled together over time, and people intermarry, and it's really pretty hard to define in some kind of empirical way what is a nation or where its boundaries ought to be. There's an awful lot of movement and an awful lot of mixing going on. But I think that behind most separatist movements, there is an idea, and a kind of unrealistic one, of we are a people, we are united, we want a homogeneous nation, and that we can govern ourselves better than others who are alien to us can govern ourselves. And it's a fundamental idea of nationalism and of separatism, which is, I think, a kind of a branch of nationalism. If you look at the, James mentioned the Declaration of Independence, it's a fascinating document because it's rather opposite of a nationalist claim. They don't really talk about how we Americans are different from you British. Quite the contrary, there are actually references in there to the British being our kindred. They talk about common blood, and it's instead what they're citing are grievances that have to do with policy and with leadership and specific events going back to 1763, but not fundamental differences. And of course, what was so interesting about America's birth was that it was a revolution, a breaking away from people who shared a common language, religion, customs of law, and history. Not all of the American colonists were British in origin, but many were, and so it was a nationalism and separatism of a very different kind than we usually think of.
Well, and it points to the one of the fundamental points that you'd have to make in a discussion like this. You can talk about cultural affinity and the need to govern ourselves over and against, but ultimately this does come down to protecting privilege as well. The reason you fight to maintain the union in many cases is because somebody gains by having you part of the group, and they're going to lose something if we let you go. Hey, Don, would you say that's part of what's going on here? And that may be a little cynical, but it goes beyond these kind of cultural wars that we see also at the root of these.
Well, it's never just one thing. I think that there were very powerful geopolitical reasons why the United States and President Lincoln in particular could not allow the South just to divide off. And some of that had to do with, I always argue, the control of the Mississippi River. And to let that go into the hands of what would be a foreign nation, I think was very dangerous. Also, it opened the door to alliances with Britain and France and old world power, Spain as well, that might have jeopardized the United States. I think that Lincoln understood that the secession of the South would be just the beginning of secessionist movements that would, he always put it, dismember the United States. But he had another idea that was very important, and I think this is more on the plane of ideology rather than territorial interest or aggrandizement of the nation. And he believed that democracy depended on the acceptance of majority rule, and that if a dissident minority lost an election or didn't like some piece of legislation and was able to successfully threaten or enact secession, democracy would never work. It would become anarchy. And so Lincoln, I think, really believed that there was certainly there might be reason for people not liking his election, but he was reaching out and assuring them that I am not doing anything that the Constitution does not allow. I'm not going to tamper with slavery in the states. I will greet you with peaceful intentions, and that if they did not like the president, that they could come back in 4 years and organize their own campaign and win. But To reject the results of an election was to destroy democracy.
Well, I want to take some more contemporary examples and bring another guest in the conversation. Brandon Gorman is a PhD student in sociology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His area of expertise is the Middle East. Brandon, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the Arab Spring, because these revolutions we talk about in terms of revolution. You have been looking at these as they emerged. Are they revolutions? And whatever they are, why are they happening now?
So are they revolutions? I think yes, but it's a very specific kind of revolution. This is what you might call a political revolution rather than a social revolution. So what you have is a change in kind at the top more than kind of a change that allows the people at the bottom to really have more say. A lot of observers of the Arab Spring will say things like, in the case of Ben Ali in Tunisia, in the case of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, that what you had was the military kind of sacrificing the person at the top so that they can kind of keep control of what's going on. Now, where I do think that this is what Charles Tilly would call a revolutionary kind of situation or a revolutionary moment is that, you know, these dictators had been around for decades. Ben Ali and Mubarak both had been around since the 80s. By and large in the West, in the United States especially, we didn't really talk about them being dictators as much because they did the things that we wanted them to do. And a big part of being able to kind of pull off one of these revolutions is to have support from the outside and have kind of powerful actors on the outside looking in and giving it the thumbs up and saying that this is really a good thing. What you saw in 2011, and this people talk about this a lot in terms of the Arab Spring, was they call it the lifting of the veil of fear. So a lot of the Tunisians, Egyptians, et cetera, they knew good and well that they were living in a dictatorship. They knew good and well that they could do very little to kind of change things. And something happened, right? Something happened. And all of a sudden, we can go out on the street and we're not getting shot, right? The police are refusing to fire on us. We're, you know, getting arrested in small numbers and things like this. But there are enough of us out here to make something happen. And I don't think that this has gone away. So I think that this continues. As we saw recently with Mohamed Morsi's decree, the new president of Egypt, he kind of made a huge power grab and people are back out on the streets. Mm-hmm. We don't know how it's going to turn out, but they are coming out in huge numbers. And this is something that while you did see kinds of strikes and protests and these kinds of things, there was the idea that there was a suitable replacement for the current regime did not exist, right? So the regime was bad and terrible, but what can we do? Right now, the regime is bad and terrible, and you know what? We can change this if we want to. And I think that's the real difference.
What about the emergence of essentially a new class, an educated class of young people who may be less, a little more secular and a little less tied to traditional cultural markers? First of all, is that true? Mm-hmm. Are they a little less secular? And are these cultural ties, tribal ties, if you want, less important? And if that's true, did that have anything to do with it?
Yeah, this is a difficult question. It's hard to know. Clearly, there's a difference in the younger generations. If nothing else, people can just talk to each other very easily. There are just more ideas. Regimes have a very hard time preventing ideas from crossing their borders now. But the idea that this group is more secular or something like this, I think, is problematic. In my own research, as a matter of fact, I've found that the younger people tend to be more prone to seeing themselves as part of a religious community. So I think that it might have more to do with the diffusion of ideas about what constitutes legitimate governance and what people, individuals, groups of people can do about these kinds of things.
You say, in a sense, Jordan was a pretty good example of this lifting of the veil because the fact is it's illegal to criticize the king.
Right, exactly. It's illegal in Jordan to criticize the king. You didn't see it very much. When you did see protests in Jordan, it was kind of more reformist oriented, where they were asking the king to change a few things rather than saying, hey, you need to get out of here. And more recently, you've had, you know, throngs of people in Amman shouting insults about the king and demanding the king step down. This is unprecedented in a place like Jordan.
On the state of things today, we are talking about revolution and secession. And we're talking with James Zink. He's an assistant professor of political science at North Carolina State. James, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Don Doyle is a professor of history at the University of South Carolina, editor of the book Secession as an International Phenomenon from America's Civil War to Contemporary Separatist Movement. Brandon Gorman is a PhD student in sociology at UNC. Coming up, we'll talk about peaceful revolutions and a new documentary on the state of things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about revolution and secession this hour. With us, Don Doyle, a professor of history at the University of South Carolina, editor of the book Secession as an International Phenomenon. Brandon Gorman is a PhD student in sociology at UNC. And joining us now is filmmaker Rodrigo Dorfman. His upcoming film is a documentary about revolution. It examines the Chilean Revolution and draws the bridge between that and the Occupy Wall Street movement. Rodrigo, welcome back to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Tell us about the film.
The film is an examination of basically what I like, which is cultural resistance, both in Chile and the U.S. And it came to me when I first saw at full frame the Black Power mixtapes. I have to say that this film about taking the voices of the radical 60s African-American radical movement of liberation and revolution. And what I found watching this film was that I found these people speaking to me directly. I thought there were voices were very much of today. And I thought, wow, here are the voices from 40 years ago speaking to me today. And I turned to my own history in my own backyard, personal narrative about Chile and the Chilean revolution that I had lived as a young child and that I had lived vicariously through my father and through my many returns to Chile. And I started asking myself, well, what are the lessons of the Chilean revolution, the voices of the Chilean revolution? What can that revolution teach us today as I was immersed in filming the Occupy movement?
And you should summarize that movement for people who don't remember. This was a peaceful democratic revolution that led to revolutionary change by the ballot.
Yes. In Chile in 1970, we had an election, and we were the first country in the world to elect a socialist Marxist president who came to power through popular vote and who then started implementing all sorts of changes. Nationalizing our national products and opening up culture to the people, setting up cheap books, culture, all sorts of things that one would find rather wholesome if they weren't attached to the word socialist.
And so this upsets the narrative of the West, which is to say that Marxism can only come by way of totalitarianism. Now we have a democratic government and socialism, and this scares the gold out of the Americans, who, by the way, then unleashed their CIA and helped destabilize and ultimately help assist illegally in the coup.
Yes,
September 11th, 1973.
Yes, Kissinger is well known as having said that we cannot allow a country to go communist because of the irresponsibility of its voters. So this is a very, you know, those are the dangers of being a republic in America and not preaching it to the rest of the world. And I think that is what maybe leads to the crisis that of 2011 in America, I think, with the surge of the Occupy movement.
So talk about the Occupy movement and how you see that related to what happened in Chile in 1970.
For me, the there's a big difference. In Chile, we took power and we had the reins of power, which is a huge difference. But yet we were fighting against a world that did not want to have this reality happen, which is how can it be? You know, capitalism should be the only model available, and the only model of revolution, as you stated, is bloody. And here we have a democratic way, and that's very dangerous. If all of a sudden, democratically speaking, people start doing a revolution, it changes the framework of how you see the word revolution. At the same time, when I was doing this film about the Chilean Revolution as archival material, basically, it happened 40 years ago, the Occupy movement started happening. And so I just grabbed the first plane available and started flying over there and visiting the Occupy movement about once a month for about a whole year. And for me, what really brought to mind was the creative capacity of people to create a reality for themselves, to say there is an alternative to a system that has been imposed on us, and we're going to create an alternative, not in our minds, but through the actual act of living together, feeding each other, as an example. And for me, the power of the people to create is where I think the real power lies in change. Not in – power doesn't come from the top. I think power comes from the bottom in people creating their own realities.
And this is something your father talked about when you interviewed him for your documentary about the peaceful revolution in Chile. Let's listen.
Look, reality is up for grabs. I know it's difficult to think that this is possible. Reality is up for grabs. We can define reality any way we want. This was only possible because the whole of a country, the whole of a continent, the whole world, we felt, was moving in the direction of saying, we can change everything. We don't have to leave the world as it was when we were born. The world can be different. Yes, we can. We said that back then. And we said another world is possible. Another world is possible right now.
Here we have a clip from Rodrigo Dorfman's upcoming documentary. His father, Ariel Dorfman, talking about what the sort of ideology and philosophy that led to the election of 1970 in Chile. So, but Occupy is sort of famously futile, right? I mean, it doesn't change anything, and that's the complaint about Occupy. There's this example, but there's no real revolution. There's no political upheaval. Nothing is changing, Rodrigo.
Yes, and I think the misunderstanding here from the outside is that we underestimate the power of narrative, of culture, and of how we view ourselves. And for me, there's a reason why people all of a sudden start identifying with Occupy, and there were hundreds and hundreds of Occupy movements across the country. And that's because the message resonated, I think, which was that for a long time, the American dream is something that we've held to be what held us together, which is that our children will have better lives than we will have. And suddenly, that dream doesn't match reality anymore. So the narrative of who we are as Americans is fractured. And so we look for other explanations and other ways of understanding what is happening and how we can come together as a country if that dream is no more in some ways for so many people. So for me, what the Occupy movement did was to actually offer another alternative narrative to how we can live together and how we can progress together and in the commons, in the public space that has been for the past 40 years taken over by, let's say, corporate voices and moneyed interests, and the capacity to come out into the streets. And so we have to be very careful because you don't know what seeds have been sown.
So here
in that
we are,
fall of 2011.
So here we are looking at this sort of this brown ground, and the seed has been planted, and you described the moment where the seed's in the ground, nothing sprouting yet. Don, let's talk about separatist movements that are also were peaceful separatist movements. I'm thinking of Catalonia, and Scotland is another example. Maybe you can talk about those sort of peaceful separatist movements and some of the groundwork, some of the unseen changes that were happening that led to the ultimate separatism.
Well, at the end of the Cold War, it seemed that in the Soviet Union, of course, a lot of its subordinate states began to break away, and it seemed like there was a contagion into places in Western Europe that I think surprised people to find that the Scottish, for example, wanted to separate from Britain, or at least wanted some kind of autonomy. It's not altogether clear that there were new grievances, new facts on the ground, new conditions that led to some sense of separatism or oppression. But that narrative became very important. Some said that in Scotland that the movie Braveheart, this Hollywood production with Mel Gibson from Australia, of all things, enlivened some sense of historic grievance against the English, and that it helped fuel the Scottish nationalist movement. And, of course, in this case, Britain, instead of trying to repress it, decided to kind of go with the flow, if you will, and to, instead of begin a civil war, to talk about devolution of powers. And that has been a way of kind of softening these tensions, to devolve powers, to allow in Spain, for example, bilingual education and street signs and menus and everything else, a bilingual culture, and of course in Quebec as well. This is a way of centralized states trying to cope with separatist movements that I think they fear might get out of hand. These are rooted in real or perceived cultural historical differences. Real or imagined, they have a way of kind of creating a reality of their own. But I don't think they're always rooted in the kind of ideological social policy issues that Rodrigo is referring to and that Brandon is referring to in Chile or in the Middle East. And it's not that they're trivial or frivolous. It's just that they, I think, are not freighted with the same kind of social and political consequences that these other resistance movements are.
Well, let's talk about that in the Arab world, Brandon. Maybe some of these unseen, these seeds that may have been planted long ago that allow for this lifting of the veil, because it sounds like from what Don just said, in a sense, it was the coming apart of the old Soviet Union that lifted the veil for the Scots. Oh, we can do this too. And you talked about that earlier in the Arab world. Was there a narrative, an underlying narrative that had been going on all along waiting for the right moment to sprout, do you think?
So that's a very difficult question. So social scientists will likely say that kind of grievances are ubiquitous. As I alluded to earlier, Bin Ali, Mubarak, had been around for decades. They had been doing the same exact things that they had always been doing for decades. Gaddafi was even older than them and was, you know, his own special brand of crazy, and his own special brand of oppressive as well. I think it's really difficult, and I think that social science research would back me up on this. It's really difficult to pinpoint this is the thing, right? This is the thing. So many times in reference to Tunisia and the Arab Spring in general, right, the kind of standard narrative is Mohamed Bouazizi sets himself on fire. Bin Ali, you know, doesn't respond to it. You know, the whole thing of his cart being confiscated, and this is kind of a metaphor for what happens to all the Tunisian people, et cetera, et cetera. People had set themselves on fire before this. People had had their property confiscated. They had been beaten and tortured. This had been going on. And so I don't know that it's possible to kind of come up with, you know, this is the one kind right. of, this is the key to creating revolution. And I think that, you know, what we've been talking about here in terms of narratives, so Occupy supplying a new kind of discourse about what society should look like, et cetera, et cetera. You said that it was, you know, you can see it as futile. Certainly we can. And I think part of the reason is because it runs up against this kind of hegemonic narrative, right? It runs up against what we consider common sense. When you're running up against what people consider common sense and you're coming up with all these ideas of we can do it this way, you know, we can feed each other, we can do away with banks, we can forgive all the debt, people think you're crazy. So something else has to happen there.
Right. But it's also by providing that model. I mean, there's a narrative, too, an explanation for what was happening, for instance, in Poland that led to the dismemberment of the Soviet Union, the old Soviet bloc. The Solidarity Labor Union, which was sanctioned by the government and considered feudal and domesticated, was in fact providing social services. It was providing for people the meals, the social network, even medicine that the government was unable to provide. Nobody thought that in a minute that Solidarity could actually foment a revolution. It was a domesticated union. And that the fact that it was doing these other things was what allowed it to become the engine of change. And I wonder if you think, Rodrigo, in some ways the Occupy movement is the same thing. At the moment, nobody notices that it's providing for people what the government and the other social and economic order are failing to provide for the middle class and underclass in this country.
Well, actually, it's very real. It's called Occupy Sandy, and they cooked 10,000 meals for Thanksgiving. And right now in Rockaway, the Occupy movement emerged. Once again, the same folks that were cooking meals at Zuccotti Park are now cooking meals for thousands and thousands of families who are not being able to be served by the Red Cross or other organizations. And it's quite the story. And it's amazing to see how these ways of being and living, of help, teaching people to help themselves, not as a handout. I mean, this sounds like a Republican, you know, pamphlet. Right. They share so many things together. In this country, we share so many things together. It's just that we come up against what you called ideology or, you know, the closing of the American mind. And that's why I think culture is so important. And I think when I speak of revolution, oftentimes I like to speak of cultural revolution. I think those go hand in hand because it is important also to supply the ideas, the stories, the narratives that allow people to imagine an alternative. Mm-hmm. We know for a fact that capitalism as it is today will not last very long. It's just the rule of history. And so we have to make sure that we find ourselves in a situation where we can offer real solutions that are real alternatives and that there's a space to imagine those. And I think that is where revolution plays an essential role.
It's sort of interesting then, Brandon, you start off with what we all have in common, whether it's a common language or a common culture or common grievances, as in the case, and then move on to this new vision, this thing that we can create, which is what we don't have in common. In fact, it's not even on the ground yet.
Right. Yeah, it's extremely difficult. People, our brains are designed to kind of follow patterns and we have habits and we know what's possible and what's not based on the things that have happened in the past and these kinds of things. I guess so. A good example here is the 1979 revolution in Iran. This was what Charles Kurzman calls this is an unthinkable revolution, right? Before 1979, the Shah is in power. He has support of the United States and he seems very powerful. And all of a sudden he's gone. Right. And there's a sea change in the way people think that reality can exist.
So they started with an idea that they'd all held in common and then moved forward in very surprising ways. Stay tuned. Thank you very much for being on the program. Brandon Gorman, PhD student in sociology at UNC. Don Doyle, a professor of history at the University of South Carolina and editor of the book Secession as an International Phenomenon. Rodrigo Dorfman, a filmmaker. His upcoming film is a documentary about revolution. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Thanks very much, Don. Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.